The Guardian.
Showtime!
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, the man who lost a spacecraft.
We sent it a message saying, if you have a problem, switch off. Switch yourself back on and then we'll start again.
Colin Pillinger tells us what he thinks Beagle 2 is doing right now.
A man who works for me, Coach Stuart Hurst, has a very plausible theory of what happened.
We discuss some of the week's top news stories.
3 days on Mercury is equivalent of 2 years on Mercury.
If there was a big wave coming to Cornwall, I would buy a flapjack and get in my car and drive down there with my boards.
And one of the world's most influential thinkers comes in to talk climate change and food bubbles.
Well, the food bubble will burst at various times in various countries. What's unique about this point in history is that water tables are falling at the same time in countries that contain half the world's people.
So what's it going to take to wake the world from its apathy?
I knew that food had been the weak link in many of the earlier civilizations that declined and collapsed, the Sumerians, the Mayans, and so forth. But I didn't think that food could be the weak link in our modern technologically advanced civilization.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back. We're all a little bit weary from a top secret mission we've been working on for next week. But enough about that for now. We've said too much already. Let's start this podcast with an interview with Colin Pillinger. Apart from awesome facial hair, he's probably best known... Well, actually, Colin, why don't you tell us what you're best known for?
I'm best known for being very awkward. I can still go around the street and be recognised as the man who launched the Beagle 2 mission. It's supposed to land on Christmas Day 2003, which, of course, we know now it didn't send any data. So whether I'm famous or infamous, I'm not sure. So I'm best known for being, shall we say, Mr. Beagle 2.
You have a new book about those experiences called My Life on Mars, The Beagle 2 Diaries. I mean, it is in many ways an extraordinary story because you were sitting at a European Space Agency meeting and somebody said, you suggested a lander, and the French said, well, who's going to do it? Your government won't pay. What are you going to do about it?
It was very much a, not only you've never built a lander, and what's more, the Brits won't pay for it. And if you read the first few chapters, the autobiographical opening to this, you'll find very soon that saying the word can't to me is a red flag at a bull. And if anybody says you can't do this, that always means I go out of my way to prove them wrong. And being told we can't have a mission to Mars was just simply an incentive to say, well, we can. Why can't we do this in Britain? We're good enough. We've got the science and technology to do it.
No government money at that point. Almost everything you did was a matter of raising funds yourself and lots of very good PR. You had to do this all the time at the same time as you're trying to design a completely radical spacecraft that somebody rather nicely described as sort of two dustbin lids banged together. But that's what it sort of kind of looked like, didn't it? Doing all these jobs at the same time.
Yes, we described it actually as a pocket watch because it was just, if you opened it, it was about as packed as you can get for a pocket watch. We decided, it was my wife and I, it was even my wife that suggested the name. And my wife said right at the beginning, you know, we have no funds. If we're going to get the money, we're going to have something which people can equate with. You know, the name Beagle 2 was chosen in honour of Darwin's ship. And from then on, we realised that it was going to be a PR campaign. But other people sort of go from the top downwards and start trying to get money from the government to begin with. We decided we'd go from the bottom up. And we'd make Beagle 2 a public mission, and that therefore we would get the public on our side, and the public and the media, and we would come up the system to the point where the government was sort of forced by public opinion to support us.
Embarrassed, you might say.
I couldn't possibly say that, but yes, it entered our head is that if we made it to the point where there would be an outcry if they didn't fund us, then, you know, there would be an outcry. And it, you know, they're politicians and they don't like outcries.
No. And when we're talking about fundings, it wasn't exactly, you know, a king's ransom. It was more like a banker's bonus, that one banker's bonus, really, that they eventually stumped up with.
The bankers probably get bigger bonuses, but now, to give you an idea of the cost, in fact, we were always seen as being in direct competition with NASA. That wasn't actually the truth, but it didn't hurt us very much to play along with that. NASA's mission, which was going at the same time, cost 10 times as much as we did, and their overspend was more than we had. But I was told by the NASA PI on more than one occasion that if he ran short of money, all he had to do was to go to NASA and say, but if those Brits were to do it with their poultry, and, you know, he didn't get to the end of sentence before they, okay, they would whip him, but on the other hand, they'd give him the money.
Some good game for them.
We often say that we contributed very much towards their mission.
So there you have the mission. It went off. It's supposed to land on Christmas Day.
5:28 a.m.
Are those moments kind of seared into your consciousness, what happened?
Well, in actual fact, we'd been sort of sitting on tenterhooks for over 6 days. Because the last time we had been able to communicate with Beagle 2 was when we spun it off ESA's Mars Express on December the 19th. Now, we had done tests on the 17th, so we knew everything was working. And everything from then on was defined, because we couldn't communicate with the spacecraft, everything was defined very closely by a timeline in the computer. And so we would know what time it hit the top of the Martian atmosphere. And we knew what time it would drop the heat chutes and open the parachutes and when it would bounce on the surface of Mars, roll to rest. And then we were waiting for NASA spacecraft to come across that site and try and pick up our signal. So all the time this was going on, I had made actually a video that ran in time with where we were in the events. So we were playing this all the time and there were people there. And it was a vigil, and there were people sort of listening intently to every second. It's a big party there waiting for this marvellous signal that we got there. And as I said, it was a NASA spacecraft, not ESA, that was going to pick up our signal. And I had to call the headquarters of the Mars Odyssey mission in JPL and ask them if they'd got the signal. And I was, as everything I did was live, I was live on a telephone and they said, sorry, there's no information for you from this pass. And then I had to break the news to everybody who was in the room. So yes, it's indelibly ingrained.
Yes. At what point did you give up hope, in a sense?
Oh no, there was no giving up hope at that time because getting a signal from a spacecraft in the first instance is often not easy. So, you know, we held a news conference about half an hour later in which I listed all the things, all the reasons why we might not have got a signal. None of them were, you know, we crashed. We weren't at that stage believing that anything as disastrous as that had happened. And we, the way it was very carefully programmed that there was a timeline of things that you had to try and in the right order. Because if we started suddenly panicking and doing anything that came into your head, you could easily confuse the computer.
Yes.
And the computer knew what to do at what times, and it knew actually what to do for the next 2 months. So we carried on for another 2 months until we got to the point where the last thing we did was the thing that everybody might have done with a computer on the first few minutes. If it doesn't work, switch it off.
Switch it back
on. Tell it to come back on again.
Yeah.
And we had that programmed into it.
Do you have a favourite kind of candidate theory about what happened?
One of my biggest regrets about this, and it wasn't a mistake, and it's described very carefully in the book, is that what we should have done, and we knew we should have done it, is that we should have been sending out a signal the whole time we were going down a beacon. And if it stopped, then we would know how far we got. We wouldn't know what went wrong, but we'd know how far we got. And we'd know at what stage there was a piece of equipment that didn't work. to do that, the European Space Agency had to turn their Mars Express towards us to listen to us. And we knew right back in 2000, 2001, that they would refuse to do that because they didn't want to jeopardise the orbiter. And NASA said, we're not in the right position, but we'll be there in 2 hours after you're due to land and we'll listen for you then. So the European Space Agency actually failed us badly by not listening. And they failed themselves because they would know too what part of Beagle 2 didn't function.
Yes, I mean, it was a European mission.
That was a huge mistake, and it wasn't of our making.
There are villains there as well, as far as you're concerned.
There were, right from the very start, from the first meeting, where we were told, you know, you can't build a spacecraft and the Brits won't pay for it. It was obvious that there were people who didn't want us to run this mission. And we felt that I personally felt that we had such an important question to answer. Is there life on Mars, or has there ever been life on Mars? Mm. If there was a chance of running the mission and doing the experiment, we should go for it. We shouldn't be sitting there thinking to ourselves, oh, we'll wait to see if Mars Express can go into orbit, and then we have another mission and we'll go try and land a camera and just take a picture. And then when we've gone through about three or four missions, we'll send the experiment to look for life. This was a big question that everybody wanted to know the answer to. And that you know, the man in the street realised we were doing something exceedingly risky, but we wanted to achieve it, and it was worth trying.
What future do you see for space exploration in general? We've got the last of the shuttles flying this year. Not much opportunity for manned exploration other than a Soyuz rocket. Is the future, does it lie with more Beagles? Does it lie with men? How do you see it panning out?
Well, again, here's a very annoying part. We, with the information we did have already, we could have gone back to Mars with a similar spacecraft, slightly adjusted, better tested, more mass, and we could have had, you know, launched several of them to increase the chances of succeeding. The European Space Agency said straight away, "Oh, we could do this by 2007," and then 2007 became 2009. Became 2011, 2013, 2015, and now it stands at 2018. That's a whole generation of children who might have been 5 in 2003 who will be 20 before the European Space Agency lands or attempts to land again on Mars. Now that to me is, the lesson in that is, you hear it thousands of times, if you fall off the bike, get back on before you lose your nerve. Now, they completely lost the plot.
That's the real failure here, isn't it?
That's a huge failure.
Yeah.
Now, the Americans will have an experiment going to Mars in 2011 that might carry an instrument that could answer some of the questions that we were asking. But it won't, in my opinion, and of course this is very egotistical, my opinion is it's not as good an instrument as we had already. Now, the future is, I've used the technology that we developed to Beagle 2. We passed the technology to the Wellcome Trust for medical research. We use the technology in the laboratory to analyze meteorites for ourselves. NASA has recognized that Beagle 2 had something rather special. So I've been commissioned by NASA to design a package, or on paper, not necessary to fly, that might be something you could send to the lunar polar regions to see whether there's water there, which would be essential to a manned base in the lunar south pole. Now that's on hold because, as you say, the shuttle's being retired. Its replacement, Ares, is being delayed by dear Mr. Obama not wanting to get involved in the moon or wanting commercial sources to pay for human launches. The European Space Agency, I've already said, are interested now, a different branch of the European Space Agency are interested in a human mission to the moon, and I'm hoping that they will take up the sort of package that we might be able to recommend to them. I don't say design because I'm probably now old enough not to start building any more spacecraft, but at least I could recommend the things that they ought to take into consideration. My brain isn't dead.
Last question, Colin. In your heart of hearts, do you think we will ever go out there, find Beagle 2, discover what went wrong with it?
A man who works for me called Stuart Hurst has a very plausible theory of what happened. And it could still be tested, but it requires somebody to have the faith to go through this communication sequence again, but using what Stuart would recommend is to time and where and how to do that communication. However, his efforts to convince either ESA or NASA to do it have all fallen on deaf ears. But I think, you know, with a spacecraft like this, it's worth it. It should still be, if it was functioning but didn't get the signal to us for a reason, that it was the antenna was pointed in the wrong direction, which is his theory, then Spirit and Opportunity are both still working. They landed a month after us. Then Beagle 2 could still be working.
So you've not given up, Paul?
Never say never.
Never say never.
Colin Pillinger there, speaking to Robin McKee. Colin's also going to be taking part in an event called Journey into Outer Space at London's Royal Geographical Society on March the 16th. For more information, go to intelligencesquared.com. His book, My Life on Mars, is out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, follow @GuardianScience.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Okay, it's show and tell time now. Robin McKee from The Observer and Ian Sample from The Guardian have each brought in their favourite story of the week to talk about. Ian, let's start with you. There's some interesting stuff about stem cells and Alzheimer's.
What's interesting about it is these guys have used human embryonic stem cells to produce the kinds of neurons that die out in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease, and these are ones which help you access memories. So in the early stages of Alzheimer's, you can notice you sort of get memory lapses, you can struggle to find the right words and such like, and that's because of these particular neurons dying out. Now, what would you use these neurons for? You can make them in a dish, but so what? You could use them for screening drugs in terms of looking at what kind of compounds keep neurons alive and well instead of dying off, but also there is talk, although it's very tentative, about using perhaps as transplants. Now, in that case, you've got to think that you'll be transplanting brain cells that you've created from stem cells into someone's head. They would need drugs to suppress their immune system to tolerate them, but more importantly, you have to make sure that there aren't any sort of stem cells lurking in what you transplant, because if you do that, sticking stem cells in someone's brain would, you know, quite plausibly lead to them growing into tumours.
So this is a research tool, a very useful research tool, rather than a tissue engineering exercise.
Absolutely. I mean, at the moment, I think it's really safe to just think of it as a way to help identify drugs for Alzheimer's and particularly for the memory loss aspect of it. I think talk of transplants is interesting, but there are significant hurdles that you have to overcome to do that.
Okay. Moving on to a scenario. Just imagine this is a scenario. You're a government minister in... I'm not sure what you'd be a government minister in, but let's say surfing. You're a surfing government minister, and there's a tidal wave on its way to the somewhere around, I don't know, where do people go surfing? Cornwall? Around there?
Yes.
Yeah. So you need to know whether to tell the surfer dudes down there to not surf for the day. Now, you know, what would you do? Would you look to the power of the kahuna to work this out, or would you go to meteorologists and say, guys, tell me, is there really a big tidal wave coming? Should I tell these two people?
If there was a big wave coming to Cornwall, I would buy a flapjack and get in my car and drive down there with my boards.
But you're a minister at this point. So anyway, the point being, the correct answer is you'd use evidence. You'd consult the scientists. I was trying to make it your level, but clearly it's even went beyond that. So there's a report. The reason I bring all of this up, of course, is that there's a report published last week by the Science and Technology Committee of the House of Commons. They were investigating the use of science by the government in national emergencies. In the last year or so, there's been plenty of those. Swine flu pandemic, the Iceland volcanic ash cloud, amongst others. They also looked at future problems with cybersecurity, etc. And it was quite damning of the government. All these emergencies, these things which cost the UK economy billions, and you know, put people's lives at risk. The scientists were brought in, the committee said, at a far too late a stage in all of these things. There's a sort of procedure that happens when anything looks like it's going to be a national emergency. Committees are set up, risk assessments are done, and something called COBRA springs into action, which I think is like the equivalent of the Situation Room in the West Wing. These people all decide what to do, how to respond. But scientists just seem to be left out of all of it. I mean, it's a bit worrying.
I think one of the trickiest things is that when the government realizes that there is a situation on their hands, what is the mechanism for convening this group of experts? And you can't – well, one option is you just have a group of people who are pretty good in an area on standby, if you like, and you could say that these are essentially some of the advisory committees you could pull in, so on pandemic flu and such like. Or do you really need to get someone like Beddington to convene groups of people who can actually say, look, the person who knows the most about this in this country is this person? And I think that might be a more powerful way of doing it, in that you get the absolute experts, not just someone who is close to it, not just someone who studied viruses. You get the absolute person in, and you get all of these people, and they kind of need to know to drop tools and get cracking.
But you don't want just one person or one group's ideas. I mean, the one thing that the MPs did point out was that the procedures, the committees that are set up, should be more transparent, so that if there are scientists in a field that are not involved, but they see something happening which they think they can contribute to, that they can then contribute. I mean, for two of the problems last year, the swine flu pandemic and the volcanic ash disruption, the government set up these things called SAGES, scientific advisory groups, but they were so, the MPs said that these were so secretive that no one knew what they were doing, and there was no code of operation, and that no government committee should ever operate like that.
It does sound quite bonkers.
It's proper Dr. Strangelove stuff,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll move on to something a bit more positive, Robin. You've just been talking to Colin Pillinger of Beagle fame. Let's look the other way in the solar system now.
Yes, that's
to Mercury.
Yeah, looking inwards towards the Sun. Later on this month, March 17th, the MESSENGER probe, NASA-built probe, will be inserted into orbit around Mercury. Mercury is the closest planet to the Sun, and this will be the first time that a robot spaceship has been put in orbit round a planet that is very much like a moon in appearance, but which has some quite odd features. It has the greatest temperature range of any body in the solar system. It ranges at its hottest to about 800 degrees Fahrenheit to when it's on bits are facing the Sun, and minus 300 on bits that are facing away from the Sun. So it's an extraordinary world in that sense. It's the densest body in the solar system. It's a huge molten core for a very tiny object. The only other appreciable magnetic field of the inner planets. So plenty of work for it to do. It's going to be orbiting one Earth year at least, studying the planet, and should provide us with a lot of interesting stuff.
The thing I remember about Mercury from my Fact Finder as a kid, it was a fascinating planet, was that someone had written that it's so hot on the surface that if you had a kettle of water, that the kettle would just boil without you having to connect it to anything. Not that there's much infrastructure on Mercury for electricity to be going around. But then it also added, and then the kettle would melt too.
Yeah.
And it's always stuck in my head. Is it true that one side of Mercury faces the Sun the whole time?
No, it's locked in a very strange orbit. Its orbit is 88 days to go around the Sun, and it takes 58 days to revolve. So I think 3 days on Mercury is equivalent of 2 years on Mercury.
Wow, that's some sort of time dilation. Okay, we'll leave all that there. Links to all these stories can be found on our blog. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Our Facebook group's also available. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
I was thinking about how to introduce this next piece.
I'm Les Brown from the Earth Policy Institute in Washington, D.C.
I was going to start along the lines of the Washington Post calling him one of the world's most influential thinkers.
The book is entitled World on the Edge.
But the guy did such a good job when he came into The Guardian.
It's about...
We thought we'd let him speak for himself.
Issues, energy, environment, food, population, water, climate change, the entire package and the interaction between the economy and the Earth's environmental support systems.
Our very own Damien Carrington's been asking the questions. He began by getting Lester to explain his concept of a food bubble,
which is a kind of newer concept. So can you explain what you mean by that and how it's arisen?
The housing bubble in the United States, which created the economic crisis we're still, the world's still trying to get out of, was confined to the United States as a bubble. What happened was that we oversold and so forth, but the housing bubble burst and real estate prices dropped 30%. In agriculture, we have, in many countries, a water-based food bubble. That is, an artificial inflation of food production by over-pumping underground water resources. A dramatic example is Saudi Arabia, which for 20 years was self-sufficient in wheat production. But they were pumping from an aquifer about a half mile down that is a fossil aquifer. That is, it does not discharge. And so in the last 3 years, we've seen their wheat harvest drop by 2/3. Another 2 years, they will be out of the wheat production business. They will have gone from self-sufficiency to zero in 5 years. Now, that's an unusually dramatic decline. But in a country like India, there are 175 million people being fed with grain produced by overpumping. In China, I estimate 130 million people are being fed by grain produced by overpumping. And at some point, that overpumping comes to an end and the pumping is necessarily reduced to the rate of recharge of the local aquifer.
So the food bubble is a bubble in the sense that it's based on an unsustainable supply, in this case, water. I mean, how would you imagine this bubble might burst and when might it burst?
Well, the food bubble will burst at various times in various countries. What's unique about this point in history is that water tables are falling at the same time in countries that contain half the world's people. We've seen the food-based, the wheat-based water bubble burst in Saudi Arabia, where they've been self-sufficient for more than 20 years, but have finally depleted the fossil aquifer they've been pumping. And so their wheat production in a period of 5 years has gone from self-sufficiency to essentially zero. And they're now dependent entirely on imported grain. But other countries like India, for example, the bank estimates that 175 million Indians are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Our estimate for China is 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. So exactly when these bubbles will burst and what form they will take is not clear. It may simply mean that production, it'll be more difficult to expand production at the national level. It may mean actual reductions in the grain harvest in India or China. We don't know yet because we don't know how fast the wells will go dry in effect. But we do know it will come.
What role does climate instability play in this? Because presumably this is another factor, as we saw from some of the extreme events last year.
The two major trends affecting world food security now and in the immediate future are rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere and falling water tables underground. We saw the heat wave in Russia last summer. Unbelievable heat. The average temperature in Moscow during the month of July was 14 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm. We saw a country on fire by early August, 300-400 new fires starting every day, and they simply could not control the burning. The Russian grain harvest, which they'd expected to be about 100 million tons, came in at about 60 million tons. So that heat and the related drought reduced their grain harvest by 40%. Now, if that heat wave had been centered not in Moscow but in Chicago, and the U.S. grain harvest had dropped by 40%, that's a 400 million ton grain harvest dropping by 40%, which is 160 million tons of grain. If that had happened, world grain stocks would have dropped to the lowest level in history. We have no idea how high grain prices would have gone. We would have seen exporting countries beginning to restrict grain exports to keep their domestic food prices under control. We would have seen then oil exporting countries begin to barter oil for grain in order to make sure they got the grain they needed. And then we would have seen other countries, mostly lower income grain importing countries, scrambling to get whatever scraps were left.
Is this why you've talked about the idea of the world being one bad harvest away from chaos?
Yes. And as we begin 2011, grain prices, soybean prices are very close to all-time highs. And the FAO food price index for the month of December did set an all-time high. And that's concentrated on in food prices in developing countries. What we're looking at now with our fingers crossed is what the prospect will be for this year's harvest, because to overcome the shortfall last year, we production was about 50 million tons below consumption, so we drew stocks down. But to avoid doing that further, which becomes difficult now because they're already so low, we need to increase the harvest by 50 million tons. We need another 40 million ton increase to cover the growth in demand this year over last year as a result of population growth, rising affluence, more grain going to ethanol distilleries to produce fuel for cars. So we need roughly 100 million ton improvement over last year's world harvest just to maintain the current very precarious status quo, to rebuild stocks and to lower grain and food prices somewhat would take probably 150 million tons.
You talked about rising demand there. That's one pressure on food. We've talked about the climatic instability, the problems of water. I also wanted to talk about the competition between food and fuel, i.e. the use of grain for biofuels, which I think from the book you think is unsustainable, something that shouldn't be followed.
Yes. In the United States, where we harvest just over 400 million tons of grain per year, last year, 119 million tons of that went to ethanol distilleries. That is over one-fourth of the grain harvest in the world's largest producer. That's one of the reasons why grain and food prices are as high as they are now. I mean, as an American consumer, this is sort of irks one because we are subsidizing the conversion of grain into ethanol, and in the process, subsidizing a rise in our own food prices. So we get to pay twice. And I think as that becomes clear to the American people, we may see the ethanol subsidy abolished. It is not very efficient to rely on photosynthesis to produce fuel for cars. Example, a farmer in northern Iowa can plant an acre of land to corn, and he may get $800 worth of ethanol from that acre of corn. But if he chooses instead to site a wind turbine on that acre, he can generate over $300,000 worth of electricity. So the great thing about wind energy and wind farms is a wind farm actually occupies less than 1% of the area that it covers. So you can still grow corn or wheat or graze cattle or whatever. And so I think the key to cutting carbon emissions, to dealing with the insecurity of oil supplies and so forth, is to electrify the transport system as rapidly as possible. Now, here in the EU, there's the 10% goal of biofuels by 2020, I think it is. I think the goal should be we should be setting transport electrification goals and switching to wind and running our cars on wind energy and electricity rather than on biofuels.
You've had a very long and distinguished career as an environmentalist, and over a lot of that career you've worried about climate change from, you know, human greenhouse gas emissions, renewable energy, but food seems to have become crystallized as the issue that might really focus the world's attention on the population, the water, the climate change issue. I mean, does that kind of come as a surprise to you in some ways?
It doesn't come as a surprise, though for a long time, I knew that food had been the weak link in many of the earlier civilizations that declined and collapsed, the Sumerians, the Mayans, and so forth. But I didn't think that food could be the weak link in our modern, technologically advanced civilization. But in recent years, I've begun to think not only that it could be the weak link, but that it probably is the weak link. And as you think about environmental trends that we worry about and that we track, climate change being one, ice melting, rising sea level, deforestation, soil erosion, falling water tables, collapsing fisheries, all of these environmental trends we worry about affect the food supply directly or indirectly. And so I think it's going to be a real challenge to produce the food that's going to be needed. And I think it's going to force a reassessment of water policies, and I think will translate into an international effort to raise water productivity and efficiency. I think it's going to focus attention on population growth and remind us that we do live on a finite planet. So I think we're going to see a lot of changes. And I also think it's going to affect our thinking about climate change. It's hard for people to get excited about, you know, whether atmospheric concentrations of CO2 are 400 parts or 600 parts per million. It, you know, you can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't taste it. How can you worry about it?
Food is much more tangible.
Right. People may not understand rising CO2 levels. They do understand rising food prices. And that's where I think we're going to get the traction needed, the political traction that we need to seriously address the climate issue.
Lester Brown there from the Earth Policy Institute speaking to Damien Carrington. That's your lot for another week. Thanks to Colin Pillinger and Lester Brown, Robin McKee as well, Ian Sample and Damien Carrington. Now, just before we sign off, producer Andy, just wanted to ask, did anyone get in touch after last week's plea?
Well, you know what, Alok, it's funny you should ask that. In my hand, I've got another piece of paper. Dave Dumas on Cape Cod, he wants the podcast put on his public radio stations there because at the moment he's having to moped to the library and download batches of podcasts to a flashcard to listen to back home on his Palm Pilot. And then there was Skip Hoffman in Atlanta, Georgia. Awesome name. He says he can concentrate better in loud environments when listening to Alok's sultry tones.
I don't know what you do, Skip, but I hope it's not important and you know, you're not operating heavy machinery or something. Now, let me look at that piece of paper. Apparently, chemistry student in Northern Italy, Lucas Marsener, he's trying to convince more of his fellow students to listen. Seems to be harder than he thought, I think. And someone called D. Strout, male or female? Oh, no, it's a he. He remembers his first podcast, Alan Bloom in a Sensory Deprivation Tank. I remember that podcast as well. Alan Bloom, the comedian.
Then there's finally Dave from Michigan. Your podcast is a very welcome distraction from my boring programming tasks.
I don't know whether any of these are real compliments, but we thank you all. To all of you who say you've been secretly listening at work as well, we won't name you, but just to don't involve us in any employment tribunals that might come out of it. Next week, well, we've got a special extended programme from a whole different country. Here's a taster.
We acquired 4 penguins, and a couple of them have stayed with us in the routine. And each of them, of course, had to have its own security badge to get into the main control room.
And there you have, I don't know, 7 or 8 ducks just sitting around underneath all the monitors. Now, don't tell me that they represent something.
Does it ever go wrong?
Actually, at the very beginning,
it should be underneath, and it wasn't at that time.
isn't that quite fundamental?
Yeah, that was a basic mistake at the very beginning.
So what happened?
Yeah, what shall happen? We smashed the experiment.
Don't miss it. There's tons of amazing stuff. Some cool videos for the website too. All starting next week from the 14th of March.
Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
That's where you'll find nearly 5 years of our programme archive. All free, of course.
And don't forget to subscribe while you're there so every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. This podcast was expertly produced by Andy Duckworth.
I'm Alok Jha.
Thanks for listening. Thanks. No, thanks.
No, thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.